Hello, this is Barbara Peters, and I am sitting with David Wagner, the author of the Rick Montoya Mysteries, and we are today talking about Roman Countdown, which is a prequel to the series, but we're going to go back and talk about some of the origins. David, your professional career is part of the reason you're writing a series of mysteries set in Italy. So what is your background?
Well, I was in the Foreign Service, and the government was nice enough to send me to Italy 3 different times. So I lived there for 9 years and got to know Italian, the language and the people and the culture, and learned to love the place. And a lot of that appears on the pages of the books.
So in your career in the Foreign Service, you were not in the consular service, but you were in the more fun part of the service, right?
I was. I was in public affairs, which included things like exchange programs and libraries and cultural stuff. So it was a lot of fun, and I met a lot of interesting people, a lot of fascinating Italians.
And this also gave you access to a lot of institutions and so forth that maybe the ordinary person wouldn't have a chance to enter?
Exactly. Some fascinating buildings downtown that you wouldn't get into normally as just a regular tourist or even just a regular resident.
So in your mysteries, part of the fun of reading the Rick Montoya mysteries is what he eats and what he drinks, either on his own or with other Italians or with Zio, his uncle, who's the senior police officer. But each of your books is grounded in a different city or town in Italy, in the local regional food, but also in the local culture. So your background in public affairs really helped you come up with or gave you access to institutions that you write about.
Right. Yeah, a lot of the towns that Rick finds himself in these books are places where I used to go to work, to meet people and make contacts and that kind of thing. So I know them pretty well. And I know that the great thing about visiting small Italian towns is that each one is a little bit different. Each one has their own culture, their own food. And I remember when I, for example, have lunch with an editor of a local newspaper, he would always want me to sample the best local dish or, you know, something special about the town. So I learned firsthand these great regional differences and how they made the country fascinating.
So it even ranges to things like particular pasta shapes or special names for them?
Absolutely. Yeah, each town might... They might have something that looks similar, like the ravioli or something, but they have a different name for it, and of course they think that theirs is the best. Like in the book that takes place in Mantova, which is a funeral in Mantova, they make tortellini di zucca, which is pumpkin ravioli. And they also make it in other towns around, but of course the people from Mantova think that theirs is hands down the best.
This is also true of cheese, right? Because cheese figures heavily into that book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cheese is as I tell people, a lot of cheese in that book, in the Montoya book.
Well, I mean, it's the murder weapon, which makes it interesting. But I thought it really highlighted, the fact that, and as part of this whole tug that various countries in Europe are having with the EU, is it how much regulation from Brussels is intruding upon local food production, local food industry, whether it's, German sausage making or wine making or cheese or whatever. I think that's part of what's going on in this whole kind of rise of populist government and nationalism, is that people don't want to see their local identity lost.
Yeah, very definitely. We were living here when they were starting to become part of the European Union with the unified currency and all that. And I always found it very strange for Italians because, your currency is almost kind of like your flag. To give that up, I always thought it was strange. But then all these things, these regulations and things that the bureaucrats in Brussels seem to be putting on them, I think that does add up, people.
Well, I've spent a lot of time in Europe in the last, 15 or 20 years. And when we were in little markets in France or, different places in Germany, you see that a lot of the local purveyors and specialists have either gone under. You know, it's helped the rise of the big supermarkets because they can meet those standards.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm trying to remember the name of the Carrefour, the French one. Virtually everywhere you go now, you know, you see and see people are, instead of shopping at their local butcher and bakery, and well, the bakeries have held up pretty well, but are more often now in the supermarkets. So it's, you know, they kind of reinforce each other. But in your books, they're still definitely local, locavore eating and regional specialties. This applies to wine too.
Oh yeah, wine probably more than others, because wines have had geographical designations and that kind of thing for a long time in Italy, which of course helps the wine growers. They like to control their own production and not let anybody else imitate them. So that's been going on for a long time. But yeah, the fight over what to call, I read something recently about the Parmigiano Reggiano, the Parmesan cheese manufacturers, or the consortium there, bringing a lawsuit against some company for saying that it was Parmesan cheese and it isn't really Parmesan cheese. So the battle goes on.
It really does. I was recently in France, and it's going on very heavily in, like, in Bordeaux about, you know, in Burgundy, about what wines are really, you yeah. know, meet their appellation and which ones mm-hmm. do not. So, but you haven't actually, in your books, instead of writing about that, the food is all celebratory and interesting, and the drinking, and you've added appendices to each of the books that allow us to experience a little more closely what Rick is eating and drinking.
Right, right, and your suggestion, which I really appreciate. Yeah, and people seem to like that, because it goes into a little bit more detail. I mean, in the book, I'll mention that Rick is drinking whatever wine, and then at the part at the end, I talk a little bit about where the wine comes from, exactly what it's like, that kind of thing. So that's a lot of fun.
It really makes them excellent travel guides, you know, if you mm-hmm. want to go to, well, your upcoming book in Urbino, if you want to go to Mantova or Volterra or the Dolomites or the Veneto, and not Venice, but what is it, Bassano is where that book was
set? Bassano. Grappa, yeah.
Right. And I like the fact that, you know, while this one's in Rome, the other places that you've gone have been smaller and sort of probably less visited, not, you know, not the, like, obvious tourist spots.
Yeah, I did that on purpose. There are places that if you've been to Italy several times, you might have gone to, but usually people, when they go to Italy the first time, they do the big cities, they do Rome, Venice, they go to Florence, that kind of thing. But these books have places that are, of course, real places, but are a little bit more off the beaten track for the tourists, which makes them even more delightful.
And they are, as we earlier discussed, north of Rome. You have not so far gone towards the south, towards the Boot Heel, towards Sicily, even to, let's say, Pompeii or Sorrento or
no.
Capri or some of those obvious destinations.
No, because I know the northern part a lot better. I really feel like I have to have spent a certain amount of time at these places.
Well, I think your books are convincingly authentic. You know, I mean, they feel as though we're there. And so if you were just making it up, if you were down in Puglia or somewhere, maybe mm-hmm. it wouldn't have
yeah,
that
exactly.
same
exactly.
feeling. I forgot to mention, too, we were talking about the food and drink, that one of the things you do, it reminds me of the New Wolf Mysteries, because there was always this sort of ending, is that Rick has a celebratory dinner with Zio, his uncle, who is a high-ranking official in the
yeah.
in the Roman police, and is one of the reasons he gets sent off to investigate things. So you always have a chance to do a kind of wind-up dinner and wine
yeah,
thing
it's,
in the book.
It's a good way to tie up loose ends and also give Rick and his uncle a good meal, which is easy to do when they're in Rome.
So what's Rick's background? We talk about his uncle, but Rick is actually Rick Montoya from Santa Fe, New Mexico. What's he doing with an uncle in Rome?
His father is a diplomat. His parents have never appeared in the books. They're mentioned, of course, and they're from the first book on, they've been assigned to Brazil, but we never see them. So Rick is a foreign service brat, as we say, and since his mother is Italian and his father is an American, he ended up speaking both languages. And so when he went off to the University of New Mexico for college, he realized that studying languages would be an easy thing to do. So he was a language major, Spanish and Italian. And so when he finished that, since he was totally fluent in Spanish or Italian, he was actually also Spanish, he said, well, why don't I become an interpreter? Seemed like a good way to put food on the table. So that's what he ends up doing. And so he does that for a while before all these books in Albuquerque, where the university was. And then he decides to move his business to Rome and see how it goes there. And it goes very well.
Well, there's a wealth of Americans and British people who come to Rome and to Italy. So he would have work there. But he also, didn't he go to high school in Rome?
He did. He did. And in this new book, Roman Countdown, he hooks up with his old high school buddies who happen to still be around. Excuse me. Because he went to the American School of Rome, where all the expat kids went, and all the embassy kids. And there were still a few of his high school classmates who were living in Rome, some of the Italian ones, but also some of the American ones. And that forms part of the story. He gets together with them. And
right, so he's actually ideal. He's in a society, but he is an outsider, and yet he is fluent in the language, and he's familiar with it. So you get to show us Italy through Rick's eyes, rather than creating an Italian character who, you know, wouldn't feel. This has been a big problem with Americans writing, you know, British mystery and vice versa today. And we have, let's say, Martin Walker, who writes this wonderful series set in the Perigord. Martin lives in the Perigord part-time, so he isn't French, but, you know, he's immersed in the, like you, you know, he's lived there and is immersed in the culture. So it feels great. You know, this current move towards cultural appropriation and objections to it does make me worry a little bit, you know, about authors who, let's say, you know, decide they're going to write, they live in Texas or something, and they're, you know, of British descent, and they decide to set a book in Nigeria, that's going to set off real alarms. But, you know, Martin lives in the Perigord, you've spent time in Italy, so you guys are kind of bolstered from that.
One of the fun things about writing these books is Rick being, in effect, part Italian, part American. He sees Italians kind of with an American point of view,
right.
And the other way around, because he runs into a lot of Americans, including in the plots of these stories, and he sees them from kind of an Italian point of view. So it's kind of fun in that way.
So Roman Countdown grew out of a couple of novellas that you wrote and had some wonderful features. So we encouraged you to turn it into a mystery. But because it was a young Rick, it ends up being a prequel. But the great thing about that is we get to see him as we haven't seen him so far, you know, as a newcomer and with no real investigative experience, and yet he's thrust into a case because a Roman count actually dies, right? Roman Countdown.
Exactly.
And the man was doing urban history focused on a street, but just urban history, so to speak, and did all these notes in English. So somebody needs to go in and translate the material he's left. His wife, the Contessa, doesn't speak English. And so Zio, Rick's uncle, is kind of pushes him into it. And this is how he gets started on what happens in your later cases. It's really very well done.
It's fun. Because it's different from the other books, and it is Rick. I mean, even though he lived in Rome, it's been a while, and it was in high school when he lived there.
Right.
And he was lived there also when he was earlier in his childhood. But this is the first time he's been back as an adult. So in a lot of ways, even though he speaks the language perfectly, and even though he kind of knows the town of Rome, he is still a kind of a newbie, and he makes rookie mistakes, and that's part of the fun of it. Because this one is definitely has a lot more humor than the other books, even though there's humor in the other books.
This one has
quite a bit.
He does some fun things, like, you know, substitute for a tour guide who gives out inaccurate information, or he has a friend from Argentina there to sell the Pope wine, and who claims that he needs Rick's translation services. But with the Count's interest in urban history, and particularly this one street in Rome, that developed from an interest of yours, didn't it?
It did. It did. I've always been fascinated by the origins of the names of streets in Rome. In fact, I wrote a book, which never got published, about that, with little paragraphs on each of the streets in the downtown part of the city, the historic center. And there's a lot of fascinating stuff that you can learn from the names of streets. Famous people that maybe wouldn't be famous to you if you're a tourist, or events that took place, or just historical tidbits that the Romans have put on their streets, because they have a lot of streets. And at every corner, the same street will change its name. So they needed a lot of street names. And so it's a fascinating thing to study.
Well, basically, it really is a urban history, as I keep saying, but the names of the streets reflect different periods of Rome, which has gone through, almost 3,000 years worth of evolution. From a small village on the Tiber to, the major power, and then fell into the pit with the barbarians. And, Rome has got the most amazing history for, and a question has come up already today from somebody, why Rome as opposed to some other part of Italy? Why did Rome rise to this enormous prominence?
Yeah, because they were just a little village. But for some reason, history moved in one way, and they started branching out, and pretty soon they controlled all of Europe. Yeah, it's a fascinating thing. Roman history is interesting stuff, and you can dive in it at any level at any century, and it's always fascinating.
Absolutely. We had a very interesting program the other night with a professor who's done a new translation of Caesar's War on Gaul, and just talking about Caesar, who was not only a strategic genius and a soldier, but enormously talented literarily, just a real, a genius, and how things might have been different if he hadn't been assassinated. What if he'd really gone off to conquer the East, which is what he was getting ready to do. And in fact, he went to Gaul in order to gain money and political capital to try to make himself, this more important figure. But why, of all of that? I think partly it's because it's a port, but you can't really explain why a particular people, for a while have all that it takes to create an empire, and then it all seems to dissipate. I mean, I was thinking the other day, looking at the, Europe at the moment and Brexit and so forth. The 16th century was the Portuguese, the 17th century was the Spanish, 18th century was really the Dutch, the 19th century was certainly the British, the 20th century kind of has been American, and now we're definitely moving towards something going on in China. So why is it, that a nation and people can rise to some level, and then it all seems to dissipate?
Yeah, and how was it that the Romans hung on for so long, for so many centuries?
Exactly. I mean, because theirs is remarkably long. Egypt and Rome both had these enormous tenures, more so than today. I was just talking centuries. They're talking millennia, which I find fascinating. So where is Rick going next, now that we've got our prequel with his early life with Roman Countdown?
He's back to the provinces. In this case, he goes to Urbino, which is a city up in Le Marche, the Marches in English, which is an area kind of east of Tuscany and Umbria. And it's this mountain town. Urbino is the home of Raffaello di Urbino, as he's known in Italian. And actually, there's a little bit of stuff about Raphael in it, although it's also about art. And the plot revolves around a missing piece of art, although it's not Raphael's art. But it's a fascinating town, and one that probably most tourists have never even heard of, let alone gone to. It's a fascinating place. It sits up on top of a hill. It was the court of Federico da Montefeltro, who was one of the most famous condottieri, soldiers of fortune in the Middle Ages. And he made a lot of money and built this fantastic castle and had this really 30-year classic Renaissance court. He had a great library, he had artists, he had literary people and stuff. So he was sort of your classic Renaissance man. So a great place to set a mystery.
Well, you've explored art before earlier in your book, set in Bassano, but it's pretty hard to discuss art on almost any part of Italy, yeah, because it was so incredibly rich with artistic endeavors of all different kinds. I mean, there were paintings, but, you know, wonderful architecture and all kinds of other stuff. And then, of course, you've got the food and the wine. And have you had any feedback from people who've traveled, used your books as a travel guide or been inspired to go somewhere because of reading one
inspired,
of your books?
Inspired to go, yeah, I get that a lot.
Do you?
People say, I'm putting fill in the blank, Volterra, whatever, on my list for the next time I go to Italy because they enjoyed exploring it in the eyes of Rick Montoya. So, yeah, I get that a lot.
Well, I think that's fabulous. I know that you refreshed my entire thought about Etruscan antiquities in your first book, Murder in Volterra. I had read years ago a book by Michael Gilbert called The Etruscan Tomb, which was, had similar interests about whether mm-hmm. there was some kind of racket about forging Etruscan antiquities going on. And it was wonderful to read an update of it. So I can tell that you've just had the best time writing these books.
Yeah, it's fun.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me.
My pleasure, Barbara. Thank you.